Free Energy Now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net. See our past lineup of speakers and upcoming shows. Or you can also download the past shows that we've done. Our guest today for May 26, 2008 is Dr. Elijah. He's with Slow Moving Water, Inc. This is a company that has a floating barge river energy turbine technology in which they use electricity to generate other usable products such as hydrogen to get around the high cost of becoming a utility. This is a technology which is definitely a clean technology and I think quite smart. So today, Dr. Elijah, we thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you guys.
Well, tell me, this barge, if I understand right, you've got basically a floating barge with turbines around the perimeter, and then you're using those turbines to generate electricity, and then rather than send that electricity directly to the grid, which would require all kind of licensing and et cetera, going through bureaucratic red tape, you're going to use electricity to electrolyze water into hydrogen and oxygen or to desalinate water and sell those as your products.
That's correct. The illustration on the website, slowmovingwater.com, shows a substantial actual boat. And this boat can be installed in any river or stream. Normally, we would probably scale the boat to the particular customer or client who wants to have this heating or cooling or metal gases that we would normally pay quite a bit for and get them for a reduced cost. An example would be a client I have in Ohio consumes about $45,000 a month in propane to dry lumber. And with the hydrogen oxygen, he would not only have zero CO2 pollution in the atmosphere, but he would reduce his monthly expenditures for propane significantly. So it's great savings in money and the environment.
When you talk about drying lumber, how would you convert your turbines into a drying energy?
Well, the nature of slow-moving water is well-suited to electrolysis. Electrolysis is a 1 volt to unlimited volts in a environment where we can separate the hydrogen and the oxygen, H2O, into its separate components. Electrolysis is a very old process. It's well-known, and we have a lot of purveyors out there. This saves a lot because we do not have to condition or transform or do any other modifications to the electricity, so we get a lot more out of the the stream of water.
So what you're doing is rather than him burning methane, he's burning hydrogen, which is a clean burning fuel, with basically H2O is the byproduct, and he's using that to dry his lumber instead of using some other gas.
Correct. And if he were to purchase the plant, he would have a return on his investment 24, 36 months, and then he would, of course, own the plant at that point, and his costs would be even much lower than what they would be just by using this saving process.
Now, you have a prototype right now. If I understand, it's like 20,000 watts?
It's actually 250,000 watts. We didn't really plan on making it 250,000 watts, but it's pretty substantial. We've got a 20,000 watt unit that's pretty simple. It uses caveman technology. The paddles move very slowly, off the shelf components. There's no high tech science going on with electrolysis or with the actual turbines. And when you say a turbine, we generally think of a directed charge or perhaps a little bit more speed than you would on one of these turntables. The turntables are, in my particular model, they're about 25 to 30 feet tall, and they have about 10 feet sticking out into the water stream. The other 10 feet of this round turntable is actually on the inside of the watercraft, so it doesn't obstruct the water.
So when you say 20 feet or 10 feet in the water, that you're basically talking a 20-foot diameter turbine, and 10 sticks into the water, 10 is sticking, protruding into the boat or the barge.
Yeah, it's a little difficult to think of vertical axis, but it's a vertical axis turntable that moves very slowly, about 6 seconds for one revolution, whereas a normal electricity turbine, which has been quite successful. I have two competitors. I don't know if they'd be competitors or not, but they're using barge and using directed water towards their turbine, but they move much faster. But the square footage they have exposed to the water is very low compared to the massive amount on this turntable concept.
So now, did I hear you right? You said these are 25 to 30 feet high. That's how deep the barge is into the water.
Right.
And so the height of the barge is spanned by your turbines that are going all the way around the barge, each one of them interfacing with the water and turning slowly as the water goes by.
It's a double-ender boat. It drafts about 35, 40 feet deep of water, and the paddles are half inside, half outside on a vertical axis arrangement. The front ones produce more, the middle ones produce a little less because of the turbulence of water. In our case, the turbulence works out beautifully if you're using electrolysis. I've been very happy with the little secrets we've come across and looked at as to the nature of slow-moving water. Electricity is great. We need electricity. Renewable energy is, you know, that's the deal. Zero pollution, zero impact on the environment. That's a delightful thing. Electricity sells, when you sell the electricity, sells for about 2 cents a kilowatt hour, maybe a little bit more. However, the consumer pays 15 cents a kilowatt hour. With the in-stream paddles, this massive area, 70,000 square feet, exposed to the slow-moving water, we're able to produce a substantial amount of power that goes directly into electrolysis, that then has hydrogen and oxygen as both a fuel, as a commodity, and of course you can't save electricity, but you can save hydrogen and oxygen. So we have a couple of substantial things, as well as the actual engineering of our prototypes. We don't use steel in our construction of our boats. We use concrete. This allows us to have a longer life expectancy, lower maintenance, lower initial cost, and it adds to the weight of the actual craft to give it more stability and deeper in the water so that the vessel doesn't actually pop out of the water, because we need the depth of these paddles to get contact with the slow-moving water.
It's hard to imagine a ship made out of concrete.
Yeah, the first concrete ship was made by Christopher Columbus. And that's a ways back in time. He didn't have the extra good rebar we have today, epoxy coated, and the other technologies. So, but his boat was successful. It did float. I don't know what the disposition of it is today or where it is at. I've been told it was in Spain. I need to put that on the website as to the first concrete boat. Because as an engineer and architect of many years building homes and looking at the realities, we have two things to deal with. We have labor costs and we have materials costs. And when it comes to boats, we can spend a lot of money on materials. Of course, this boat isn't designed specifically to go across the ocean. I feel because it's so, there's not very many voids that could fill with water on the boat. So I would think it could take a pretty severe pounding and come out ahead. The generators are marinized, but they're above water, which is a very good thing for maintenance and for cost effectiveness. The in-water turbines, of course, the turbines are underwater, so you're using high-tech seals, and you're having to deal with that on a different level, so your costs are higher. And our major item is to bring to market a fast, easy-to-assemble product that makes a huge amount of power and is multi-use, platform distillation of water and other products, which in my scenario, my own personal need is to have a massive amount of hydrogen oxygen for my CO2 burner, and that is used to burn up CO2 and to add to power plant smokestacks to render them CO2 zero, so there would be no pollution in the power plant, even though it's a coal-burning power plant. So this technology is vitally needed to stop global warming and to help every aspect of our situation. It decentralizes our entire grid by allowing other producers to generate their own power. We don't have this long transmission lines, even if we do make electricity, which is fine. It's hydrogen oxygen, when it is burned, emits zero pollution. That's a good thing. Hot water is basically its only component that it produces. And that's a good thing.
Now, when I was thinking about this technology, it made a lot of sense to me, because when you have a fixed turbine, you know, say affixed to the bottom of a river, for example, you've got to worry about sandbar collection. You've got to worry about the river moving up and down, height of the river, and you have to worry about boats going over the top that may not see it, that would run into it. Whereas this thing is going to, because it floats on the water, it's going to be at the right level wherever it's at. And if you want to move it, you just move the barge to wherever you want to have it. Those aspects seem to make a lot of sense.
There's other ideal aspects also. Because it's electrolysis, we're not required to have any set RPM on the generators. And that makes a big plus. On a turbine, you have to come up to speed and stay within your selected speed. So the turbines are pretty site-specific. This unit can be used any water source that is slow-moving. And we've tested in, I guess it's 0.1, one-tenth of a meter per second, and it produces a substantial amount of power. Slow-moving water, in my book, is dictated at being 1 meter per second or less. A lot of our rivers move a lot faster than 1 meter per second. Some cases we have water moving, you know, 3-4 times that, 24/7. Mississippi River, very fast flowing river. It looks slow, but it is quite fast. So that resource there, if we just look at it on a map, has a huge amount of possibilities, because there is no concrete to pour for a dam. There's no weirs to direct the water. It's basically a free energy system that is designed specifically to take advantage of everything we have going on. When you make electricity, you have FERC guidelines to go to, lots of meetings. At this moment, a couple of states have some guidelines on explosive gases for notification and safety things, and I'm all for that. Hydrogen has a bad reputation because of the Hindenburg, and a lot of that information now is much more well known as to what really happened. Of that disaster, 12 people perished, but they had an entire party of 220 or something like that on board this airship.
And I understand
it burned.
Also the reason that burned was not because of the hydrogen, but because of the paint on the dirge.
Actually, that is true, yes. Now, mind you, if you get hydrogen inside of a building trapped in a roof somewhere, it can easily blow the roof off. This has happened for couple of the people that I'm associated with, that things do happen, but we have these new hydrogen detectors, which are well under $100, and they're delightful because they do work and they're good alarms. They can send you alarm a long distance by internet or telephone. So we do have the safety protocols in place and the training necessary to make this a reality, plus the storage system, which goes along with this particular item. So it's kind of like it's a bigger entire system that I've designed to take advantage of slow-moving water, which is the big problem we've generally had with hydrogen, and that's storage.
Yeah, one of the things, as I look at your system, and by the way, if people want to take a look. We do have coverage of your system at peswiki.com, P-E-S-W-I-K-I, under Slow Moving Water. Of course, they can look at your website as well, slowmovingwater.com. But as I look at this little barge thing with the turbines going around the edge, I'm trying to picture the complexity. If you were to make these plans available under license, for example, it seems like it'd be quite straightforward for people to build these and to scale them to whatever their application is. The only thing that would probably be required for some special engineering would be the shape of the turbine. Would that be something? What would be kind of the limiting or the in terms of production? If I was in New Zealand and I wanted to build one of these, what would be the limiting factor?
It's amazing. I have used government surplus permanent magnet generators, and now we are hand wiring our own generators because of the slow speed. So really, it's an archaic technology that has come back to rescue us, that we can use a very caveman-like technology to make this really work. And there's a lot of different designs that will come out of this situation, and I already have people in South America and in Pakistan and the entire Arab Emirates that want to apply this. And I've seen some really interesting designs. I'm really impressed with the ingenuity that people come up with for improvement. In this particular scenario, it's pretty hard to lose. We're probably going to come up with an ultimate design which will take advantage of all the parameters of turbulent water, because where the ship is located could make a big difference in how much it's going to produce. The plus thing is because of the low initial cost and the enormous amount of hydrogen oxygen that you can make, it makes up for things. So you might only be using half of the ship's capacity, but still realize you're making good progress in your financial sector.
So in terms of, let's just, for argument's sake, say that you're producing electricity and you didn't have to worry about the phasing of it. In other words, you've got to have your generators turning at a particular speed. At what price would you be selling electricity once you take into consideration the installation and capitalization costs?
Yeah, figuring a 20-year return on investment, which is very long for this boat. In hydrogen, it's much shorter. But 20-year return on investment, figuring you're paying enormous taxes to the state for the right to generate electricity because you're moored in state lands and making power. And the energy market, more or less, you've got pretty low sales in hydroelectric, but down south in Arizona where coal-fired power plants are the norm, you have higher money you could make. So there are places where you could make a little more. We're looking at around 3 cents, 5 cents a kilowatt hour to be put back into the grid with a 20-year payoff, and a lot of other perks that go along with that. So it's a very doable resource for the grid power, and very, very well conditioned. In our case, we don't use generators at the turntable top like you do in electrolysis. We actually have used hydraulic fluid or another pumped fluid that would go down into a turbine and would have a backup zone where we would be able to take the slacks and pushes that are inherent with turbulent water. Turbulent water has a tendency, if you have a propeller at 90 degrees to the water, it produces a pretty constant power flow. And the Gorlof generator, delightful machine, it works very well also to give you continuous horsepower. The paddle wheel, this vertical paddle wheel, has a tendency to be episodal, and so it has a little bit of a jerky motion to it. Works well for electrolysis, but in electrical generation, we need to have a buffer tank which equalizes the pressure. So, yes, it will work, and the technology is there. And, of course, our turbines would not be underwater, so it would make things a little easier to do maintenance and things of that nature. And I'm not against the in-stream turbine, but there is the fish item there that when the turbine moves a little faster, it could cause some type of environmental hazard. Although all that I've seen, it's very low. the in-stream turbine is a good design, and it will see a lot of application in the near future.
So if you were to turn this into an electricity generator scenario, you're in the same ballpark as fossil fuel energy, coal, natural gas, which is in the ballpark of 4 cents per kilowatt hour. You're saying 3 to 5 cents per kilowatt hour. But what you're doing in your scenario is rather than going through all of that rigmarole of getting, you know, the steady electrical output, you're just going to go straight to electrolysis, which doesn't require a steady electrical output. You can take whatever you have and use that to electrolyze water, whether it's low or high output. And the amount of electrolysis is proportional to the energy you're putting in. And then you're selling the products of electrolysis, the hydrogen, oxygen. And is that the same scenario for desalination or for purification of water?
I guess I would kind of go backwards and say that in my plan, I would always, 90% of the time, make hydrogen oxygen that would possibly be shipped ashore to a power generation plant there. Because hydrogen oxygen burnt produces no pollution, and because you can save it up, you could then go to electricity at that point, which I see as much more favorable on demand. So if you're needing an extra gigawatt of power, you turn on your rotary engine turbines and or your engines and start producing power. Whereas if you were to run the turntables direct to electricity, I think my own opinion is that it's not a win-win scenario. But by pumping the hydrogen oxygen ashore, you actually get more bang for your buck from what I have really worked hard to look at in the over unity of hydrogen oxygen being generated as compares to electricity generation, because you do have some losses in that, and you don't in the you have actually more production in electrolysis due to the nature of slow moving water. So it works out to be far better to pump the gases ashore and run a generating plant for on demand right then and there, and I'm really in favor of that scenario.
I know a number of very interesting scenarios for highly efficient electrolysis processes. We have a fairly extensive electrolysis directory page on our website at teswiki.com. You might want to take a look at some of those. They'd be a good marriage for what you're doing. They'll use things like, you know, pulsing and frequencies and stuff to help make the bond breaking of the oxygen water or the water molecule much more easy, so you're using much less energy to get more gas out. And so
exactly.
Matching that technology.
I'm looking at that technology now, and I'm amazed at the ingenuity of individuals and their intuitiveness as to what works and what doesn't work. And the built-in nature of turbulent water is well suited to making hydrogen oxygen through electrolysis.
And when I look at your barge floating in the water there, I see like six turbines along the left side, six along the right, and then one at the front and then one at the back, or one each on the front and back on each side. And as I picture the water going by those, I could see that the front ones would get the most gain from the water going by them, and the ones further back are going to be getting less because they're being, you're getting the shielding of the ones in front of them going to be slowing down the water, so you're not going to be getting as much gain from those as you do from the ones in front of them. Would it make more sense to have a shorter barge so you don't have as much of that shielding effect?
If you were to put a director on the front of the boat, it could change some of the characteristics of the turbulent water. Oddly enough, the turbulent water is very, it's amazing that it gets a pretty even shot on all the turbines together. The front ones definitely get more power because the water is split by the bow of the boat. So the first one actually gets more power than the rest of them. But they all seem to be about pretty normal pretty well matched to the turbines in their power output. Of course, it's going to, the individual stream and the flow characteristics are interrupted by underwater obstructions, rocks, and the sandbars that may or may not be there underneath. So in this particular case, I see taking the bulk, just over the overview, the general, and estimating it. Once we get one or two of these out there in the world generating hydrogen oxygen, we'll get a much better idea of what works and what doesn't work. On my 250K, I have a small paddles, really, 4-foot sheets of plywood with iron on a automotive-type bearings that produces power horizontally. And I'm just amazed that on a regular barge or any type of a floating apparatus, you can produce a huge amount of power right at your house. And because you don't have to produce electricity, you can save this up and use it for later. Electricity you can't save, hydrogen oxygen you can save. So there also may be the possibility of individual operators, which I like to see. Our dependence on foreign oil needs to be addressed quickly and efficiently. That's what this does. And it allows for individual operators to enter a market where they would not normally be able to enter in. So there is a pretty good chance of coming around with a truck and picking up gases from these individual producers who can then get a check every month from their particular location and how much hydrogen they produce with their apparatus. So that's a really good thing for the economy, not to mention the fact that we don't have one centralized power plant, but perhaps hundreds of these small plants that would be servicing industry, individual buildings, and, of course, communities where a co-op would not have to pay for taxes because the co-op is owned by all of the people. And then grandma or disabled person could get their heating and their cooking for much lower price. Right now, heating gas is fairly high, as we all know, and I wouldn't even quote a price today because tomorrow it's going to be higher. But hydrogen oxygen, there's no market for that. It's electrolysis is there. Water is there. Everything is going to be the same, and it's going to remain very stable for a very long time unless government intervention, taxes, things can occur that probably will. Electricity is heavily taxed, as we do not know. Fuel is pretty heavily taxed, but not like it is in Europe. So I envision that hydrogen oxygen will be taxed, although for the individual operator, there's no way for you to right now tax the individual operator and know even what he's producing other than what is voluntarily given. And in the, I guess it's about, probably around Christmas time, we'll be close to completion on what we will call the self-fueling boat. It's not yet on the website, but it will be, and that will be a 64-foot long experimental craft that'll have a variety of turbines and scenarios we can construct and deconstruct and test as a bed to see how and what technologies work the best and are easy to deploy, don't get clogged in the stream with detritus and whatnot, what works best for tidal estuaries and other things of that nature. We have vertical axis generators that are permanent to the floor. We have the floating ocean drifty, and there's just a tremendous amount of new things that have never been seen by man. And it's just a wonderful scientific endeavor to be in that entire world of, you know, I would call it pure energy systems. Renewable energy is fabulous. We have not used it very much or enough. We're behind in the world's consumption of renewable energy, but we're going to catch up because of the amazing ingenuity and need for our own country to make our own power and reduce costs.
One thing we've not talked about is an obvious application here of the use of the hydrogen and the oxygen. Besides just running generators for electricity, there's also, you know, vehicles can use hydrogen, obviously, for fuel. I've got a friend, Ty Robinson, a member of our New Energy Congress, who, for a living, he modifies vehicles so that they can run on hydrogen, or actually multi-fuels, hydrogen, methane, other fuels, so that you can actually switch between whatever's available. And, you know, he's running around town at 37 cents a gallon for his natural gas.
I'm a big advocate of that. As electricity has not gone up as much as gasoline has, we can make a quick computation and say that around $1.50 of electricity will make you the equivalent of a gallon of gasoline and hydrogen oxygen. I don't like it very much because of where the electricity is probably coming from. But with renewable energy, we're not required to have a voltage-regulated transformed supply. So we're going to see a lot of these unregulated power sources being built and tested for home generation of hydrogen and storage. And I would now be a good time to spring the storage item on everyone.
Yeah, go ahead.
Storage has been the major issue for hydrogen. Normally, these big, long tanks, they're fairly about 2 foot diameter and 30, 40 feet long, compress the hydrogen to 10,000 PSI, and then it's transported to its location. That's normal. And then, of course, liquid hydrogen, which is about 6 tenths of a pound per gallon, and that's pretty lightweight for a gallon of liquid that's 300 below zero. And, of course, it off-gasses as it warms up because it's very hard to keep something that cold, even in a Dewar container. But there's a new kid on the block, Savannah River Lab. They have a nuclear power plant at Savannah River, and they've pioneered a lot of the hydride, which is another technique to hold hydrogen, far more efficient than 10,000 PSI or the liquid. And so it's a great improvement. Their tank is kind of square, pretty boxy, operates at about 200 PSI maximum, and it holds enough to run a vehicle for quite a ways. So we're going to see pretty big gas tanks on the cars and trucks. Or in my scenario, I see the diesel trucks going to massively huge propane tanks. Now, these propane tanks originally had propane, but in our workings, we will no longer use them for propane. We will put what is called hydrides in the bottom of the tank, and this will hold the hydrogen much more efficiently than either liquid or 10,000 PSI. Propane tank operates at 200 PSI or less, and you will be able to hold your entire fuel to go all the way across the country in one tank of gas. So this is really exciting things for companies that have the resources to fuel their own fleet and to hold costs down to a minimum. So we're going to see competition, which I love. I think competition is a wonderful thing to allow ingenuity and inventiveness to come to the front and be used to bring a better product to the market. And in this case, a win-win scenario, because it's a clean product made with renewable energy that gives the individual much more control over income rather than a monopoly or extra large company that has this huge network that we don't have very much control over or even understanding of. And I really advocate that. So I'll go into the transition group metals. On your periodic chart, you have hydrogen on the one side and helium on the other. And down in the middle is transition group metals, a vast number of metals which absorb and desorb hydrogen at various rates and under various pressures and temperatures. My favorite is titanium, which cycles many, many times, 30,000 times, and holds about a little over half of its weight. So 1,000 pounds of titanium would have the ability of holding about 500 pounds of hydrogen, a pound of hydrogen is, 60,000 BTUs, or about three times the bang of propane or gasoline. Some people say a kilo is equivalent to a gallon of gasoline. We'll wait and see how that goes. I would say give the benefit of the doubt over the top, and if we did have a kilo of hydrogen, it would definitely be much more of a fuel than a gallon of gasoline or diesel. Of course, gasoline, less gas mileage. Diesel, more gas mileage. Diesel with hydrogen augmentation, great gas mileage. Hydrogen, unlimited gas mileage. And that's due to the fact that you can make your own hydrogen, and the cost of making that hydrogen is much lower and fixed than it is for the petroleum fuels.
What percentage of the U.S. population, for example, lives close enough to a moving body of water that could be used in this manner? What percentage of the country could be powered by this technology?
This is amazing. It comes out to be somewhere like 80% of the population is within 35 to 50 miles of a slow-moving water body that is definitely able to be used for power generation. The desert cities, even Las Vegas, is within the realm of having a massive power plants on the Colorado River. We have the Hoover Dam, which, and the I forget the other dam in the upper reaches, and those produce a huge amount of electricity, but they dam up a lot of water, and they've disturbed the ecosystem, and they've changed the water table. And I'm a real advocate of hydroelectric, but there are downsides on hydroelectric. We're losing about 60 dams a year, small dams, across the United States due to old age, safety hazards, and environmental concerns. So this may be an answer to those dams that are being torn down and replaced by slow-moving water power plants.
And if, in a scenario that 80% of the U.S. power came from this kind of a scenario, how kind of, if you run the numbers on what the rivers would look like in terms of the number of barges that would be out there generating that energy?
Not very much. Ideally, you probably would not see very many of them. The Mississippi River is a huge resource which has many places to sequester a power plant without it being seen by anyone. There's a large number of barges that run up and down the river, and that's a pretty normal thing to see. They're very large in comparison to the size of a slow-moving water a power plant. And, of course, they might be semi-permanent or permanent, depending on the owner and the operator. But I don't, you know, I can see that there could be a situation where someone might not like where the power plant is at. And if I was the operator, I would pull my anchors and I would move to a new location. But of course, if someone owns the land down to the river and has some type of a dock, there isn't, I cannot imagine there being very much restriction to having that power plant next door because of its great planet-saving capabilities and the amount of income that goes directly into the community. With an electric power plant, we don't see the income. We're going to pay our electric bill, but we don't see the income coming in from paying that electric bill. Whereas if the community owns their power plant, they can control what happens with this resource, not just electricity, but heating and cooking and industrial resource, and opening up new markets, which are very environmentally low impact, the lowest impact we could possibly have because it produces no pollution and it doesn't affect the environment negatively like a hydroelectric power dam does.
Let's talk for a second about the logistics of conveying the oxygen, hydrogen that you're making on board these vessels to shore. Are you doing it via pipes? Are you going to do it via boat? How are you getting that ashore to where it can be transported or piped to where its destination is?
We presently have a pretty well-defined transportation system for propane, butane, liquefied petroleum gas. And I'm going to more or less duplicate that overall. The giant, the pretty good-sized propane trucks that deliver propane to the individual user will be our vehicle of choice. It won't deliver the same amount of BTUs per truck. You're not going to be able to get a huge amount of BTUs in a converted propane truck. But it'll still be substantial enough to be able to be very usable and very doable because of the close location to the actual power plant. So rather than, in my case, the propane truck has to drive about 80 miles north to get the propane for a fairly good price and then drive it all the way back. In our scenarios, it'll probably be 15 or 20 miles to go to the plant to pick up your hydrogen and deliver to the client. So the trade-off of volume, a regular propane truck might hold 2,500 gallons of propane, a large number of BTUs. The new converted hydrogen truck would hold about half possibly a little bit more, depending on what kind of hydrides. And while I'm at it, I guess I should say that when we do begin to produce propane tanks that are converted for third world countries, right now we're working with a project to begin delivery of cooking gas for a South American country concern. We will have to individually tag each propane tank with the type and cycling rate of that individual hydride. So we'll have tanks that will be stamped with the individual hydride content, iron, titanium, possibly palladium ore, nickel. There's all kinds of resources for your individual need. And one of the problems of hydrides is the off-gassing characteristics. For the customer, he wants to get his fuel right now. He doesn't want to wait around, and propane takes a little bit of time to deliver, but hydrogen could take double or triple the time for the same number of BTUs to go into the tank. So that's probably a concern, and it's something we'll probably have to work with. I don't see the downside when a customer is paying $2.29 a gallon for fuel, and then he can come over and get hydrogen for half of that, or probably a lot less, depending on the co-op they're working with or the individual supplier.
Mm-hmm. Part of my question had to do with getting the hydrogen and oxygen from the barge to the shore.
Right. Well, 200 PSI line, poly line, reinforced poly line, a lot like electricity, has to come ashore. This technology is pretty well proven and is fairly bulletproof. In the unlikely scenario we did get a leak in one of the lines, it would be noticeable through the bubbles that would be produced, but more than anything else, that as long as this leak is not in an enclosed space, it has very, very little harm in the gas escaping. It goes up, it takes off, it dissipates, it's gone. So it's a 200 PSI line as versus other high-pressure lines, which are far in excess of 200 PSI. So I would consider it to be a fairly safe technology if you were to pump gas ashore. Propane boats, actual ships dedicated to liquid petroleum gas, unload down the street for me frequently, and I was able to look at their technology, talk to the engineers, and do a little research. And I'm very confident that this is not an obstruction to deployment of this technology.
The lines that are running from the barge to the shore, if you needed to move the barge, would you roll those up? How would you move the lines?
I see a post which would be dedicated to the hookup of the gas lines. That's what they do now, and I would stick to that scenario. It's actually a post permanently put into the bed of the water, and then they hook up to that individual post with quick-release connections. And these are not low pressure, but 200 PSI is considered to be low pressure in the industry. So it's pretty well-proven technology, and you'd basically take your quick-release, hook it up, depending on your volume. On a big boat, it would be pretty good size, and you'd need a serious amount of storage on shore to, you know, if you were going to save the equivalent amount in propane, you'd have to double the number of tanks that you would have to store hydrogen. And, of course, oxygen is another commodity which we are well associated with, compressed and liquefied oxygen. So that would be an additional amount of money you would get from the process. You can burn hydrogen alone, or you can burn it together with the oxygen. That's called Brown's gas. And it has some unique characteristics which are still being investigated.
Yeah. We have a page on Brown's gas on our website. Very fascinating stuff.
It
doesn't store very well, though.
No, and oxygen has its own set of problems, as well as hydrogen. But the industrial gases have been well understood for 100 years, and it's a well-developed industry that will be used. We can use all of their technology and their know-how to make this a pretty seamless transition. The United States is pretty far behind everyone in renewable energy, but South America and China in particular is a massively huge market which desperately needs pollution control. hydrogen oxygen offers that. Hydrogen oxygen made with renewable power source and massive amounts of it is of extreme interest to the Chinese.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the size of the tanks on shore for a typical setup, what are we talking about? I mean, if you're trucking that off to some end user regularly, then you don't have to have very big tanks, but you're going to have some holding capacity there. And it's for each time you move your barge, you're probably going to also need to move those tanks.
Yes, that's true. Each customer, we can think of his a customer's normal supply. We look at what he has. And if he has a big 5,000-gallon propane tank, what he'll wind up with is two 5,000-gallon tanks. And they'll be converted from propane to hydrogen. So basically, you double the storage capacity that you had originally. And if you had one tank, you now have two. If you had four, you now have eight. So it doubles the number of tanks, which is not undoable. It certainly is within the possibilities. And since we already have propane tanks, the cost in construction is well known.
Uh-huh. Now, in terms of size and logistics of moving, it's easy to move a barge. You just, drag it where you want it to go. But those tanks won't be as easy. Some of them could get pretty big. You've got to, get those down the road. That could be pretty unwieldy. The initial installation can take months on depending on the size of your tanks. So would that present a problem in terms of the mobility that we talked about earlier?
Probably not. We have the regular 10,000-gallon propane tank, which is easily transportable by semi-tractor trailer. And that's what we'll stick with probably overall is that particular tank.
It's
easy to load with hydrides to inspect and to deliver via a semi-tractor trailer.
Mm-hmm. So basically,
and a lot of times I see that we'll probably dedicate a trailer specifically to carrying the hydrogen. So it'll be probably a propane tank, a trailer combination that will sit there semi-permanently in a location ready to be moved at a moment's notice. For disaster relief or for other purposes in interstate transportation of hydrogen gas, I think this will be the real wave of the future. And also, even for individual consumers, we now have a system called PPX, which is propane exchange. And instead of the propane exchange, we'll wind up with hydrogen exchange. Same tanks, a little bit less BTUs per tank, but still wonderful stuff, especially if you're going to have a barbecue, which on Memorial Day, we'll be having a lot of barbecues. Hydrogen oxygen flame, or just the hydrogen flame in your barbecue, produces a delightful amount of moisture for all of your cooked goods. And it's amazing. Regular propane has a little bit of moisture in it, but not like hydrogen oxygen does. So it does not dry out the meats at all, and it's a delight to work with.
Mm-hmm. Now, tangentially, I'm just curious, one of the end users of a hydrogen product would be fuel cells. And presently, fuel cells are quite expensive. A fuel cell vehicle took like $1 million. And so obviously it's out of the price range and the practicality. They're working on bringing that down, but they're looking at 10 years from being commercially viable. What's your take on the fuel cell industry? Is it going to become something that will be practical anytime soon?
Based on what we've seen so far, it's been slow to take off. It's had a few problems. In respect to slow-moving water, we make a very pure product, and so the user of the fuel cells will definitely like this. This will be a big plus to them, and I see that it'll probably make its way into smaller components, which have dropped in price. We have a hydrogen-powered bicycle which uses a fuel cell. I think we paid $1,800 for it. It goes about 40 miles on a hydrogen charge, which I charge myself, and I've been pretty amazed that it goes 40 miles on hydrogen, and it's a fuel cell. My own take, I don't see fuel cells being in cars directly because of the tremendous amount of power you get from the rotary engine. The rotary engine is specifically designed to run hydrogen. The regular piston crankshaft engine is really not well suited. BMW has done a wonderful job to make a super powerful car running on hydrogen. Kind of complicated, but with the Mazda rotary engine, it is very easy to convert over to hydrogen, and a little bit of change in the engine components that are able to withstand the water. The exhaust system has to be stainless steel and a few other items. But mostly the deployment of that has been held up by the volume of hydrogen available to get to the engine to run these high-powered machines, which we have normally a pretty good-sized power plant in all of our cars and trucks, and we need to continue to be with that. So the gas tanks are bigger, just flat bigger. The vehicle we have planned is a RX-8, and the entire trunk is occupied by fuel tanks. But in our scenario, we're hoping to be able to get all the way across to New York City from Seattle on one tank of fuel. And that'll be a great thing for us because there aren't very many hydrogen fueling stations out there yet. California has a bunch, but they're not really unified in that some are liquid and some are gas, some are high-pressure gas, and so we haven't really come up with a hydrogen power fueling type scenario other than these individual providers, which will spring up like crazy once they realize that we can sell our fuel immediately to the natural gas market, pump right into the pipeline, and industry wants this hydrogen oxygen for their own needs because of the enormous increases that we've seen in petroleum products.
This friend of mine, Ty Robinson, who's converted his truck at Toyota Tacoma to run on these multi-fuels, you know, it's the same engine that is running hydrogen and natural gas and ethanol, and he just has a switch, you know, that goes whatever he puts in the tank, that's, you know, turns a little switch, let the engine know what's coming in, makes some adjustments, and off he goes. And, you know, he's expert at what he does. The point I'm trying to make is that the existing infrastructure, the vehicle infrastructure, is compatible with hydrogen, is compatible with, you know, ethanol, these other fuels that are coming along. And ethanol, of course, when it comes from algae, not corn, is a viable energy source.
Boy, we're in total agreement on that one. Yes, I agree. Much of the world has flex fuel. Brazil is, they have really gone great with the flex fuels. China and Japan, much of the world has flex fuel vehicles, and it would be nice to see a lot more of them here in the U.S. because I'm in agreement with you. We have the resources available. There's no reason to run your vehicle totally on any one fuel when you can get the right fuel for the right price and go for that. I'm on the other side a little bit because I want to see zero pollution. We're in a global warming scenario, which is going to cause massive problems with desertification and change of weather patterns. We're seeing greater hurricanes and stuff. So hydrogen has this amazing effect of not being electricity, but having uses for hurricane dampening, for bringing huge amounts of water vapor to the atmosphere to combat desertification and to overall reduce the CO2 imprint tremendously because of the CO2 burner, which could be deployed very soon.
Actually, the water vapor is an issue. Water vapor itself is a potent greenhouse gas, and if all the cars started running on hydrogen, it could present a problem in terms of the water vapor content in the air could pose similar hazards to what we're seeing with CO2. It's a different kind of hazard, but it would be similar in terms of global warming. But another point I wanted to make with the my friend's car, Ty Robinson, his website, by the way, is hydrogen or intergalactichydrogen.com.
Intergalactichydrogen.com. Got it.
Yeah. He hasn't filled his car up with petrol for a good 2 or 3 years. He's been able to, in all his travels, he's found enough of tanks with or filling station with either hydrogen or natural gas or ethanol that he's not had to use petrol at all.
Fabulous. Fabulous. While we're on that subject, I'm going to go back to methane for a moment in greenhouse gases and then continue your bent. We have a huge amount of methane being released, and that is an issue also. Mm-hmm. So while we're dealing with that, I'm hoping to get some methane to run vehicles on that as well, but it seems to be pretty complicated and not a very good gas. It doesn't burn very well.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
Well, methane, it is a clean-burning fuel in terms of it burns very efficiently because it's such a small molecule. You don't have things going unburnt through the engine like you do with the larger molecules involved in petrol. And one of the reasons that these, hydrogen injection scenarios where you have onboard electrolysis injecting the hydrogen oxygen into the air intake that catalyzes a more efficient burn of the fuel is because it makes those, it apparently breaks down the larger molecules into smaller molecules so they burn more completely. This Robert Pritchett, who is in Washington, I'm going to be seeing him tomorrow, he converted a vehicle this last week. He went from 10 miles per gallon to 20 miles per gallon by making that modification.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, this old Ford van, double the mileage. Before we end this segment, I'd like to just give you a chance. This isn't the only technology that you're working on. You've got a number of other ones, a CO2 burner or something like that, and a number of other technologies. Just give us a quick thumbnail about these other technologies.
Wow, that's a big one. Well, Terra Preta, or biochar, is on the agenda. The self-fueling boat is more than just making hydrogen. We actually want to produce a boat that makes its own fuel every day in operation. That goes along with our ferry plan to have a water taxi here in the Puget Sound. We're also working on methane acquirement. There's called a hydrate ridge off of the coast of Newport, Oregon. And methane hydrates are well known, and they're being released as methane bergs that float to the surface. And we're hoping to salvage or get them. I don't know what we're going to do, but we're going to give it a try, as well as our Ocean Drifty, which is a tremendous program to study the ocean currents and to bring attention to this huge heat sink we have on our planet called the ocean. We have a lot of cold water mixing up north of the Greenland ice sheet melting, and it's changing weather patterns. And we need Ocean Drifty to bring attention to this situation and to document changes that are going on. Our space program is really fantastic because we're a passive space travel program, and I'm going to kind of leave it as a teaser so that we don't give too much away. It's really easy to do. We're going to see a lot of third world countries involved in it very soon, and to bring the cost and accessibility of near interplanetary travel cost effectively using hydrogen. So I'll leave it with that. Gosh,
One other quick question before we run out of time here. I also wanted to ask you about your intellectual property protection on this barge idea. How much of that is covered and what is covered?
I've got a bunch of protection on it, but I'm really encouraging all of mankind to take these ideas and run with them. We've run out of time in the global warming scenario, and I have other ways of making income. I'm not worried about my patents. I have not had really great luck with the patent type scenarios. And I really invite everyone to experiment and to try their own particular versions on this inventive and wonderful technology using renewable energy to produce this low-impact gas that just does so much and is going to be used in the future extensively as we do get into a true hydrogen economy around the world.
Well, one thing we haven't mentioned, as I was about to say, Dr. Elijah, is Dr. is actually your first name.
Yes, I've got one of those PhD things and a master's in business, but I don't put much stock in the academic situation as versus the true ingenuity of all Americans and all humans around the world to do their backyard, and I'm going to say backyard science thing, because what I do is really backyard science. I use caveman technology in a modern, very technologically advanced society to solve problems. So I don't see any of that scientific academia being of real good use. And if we do see it being of good use, great, wonderful. But what we're dealing with is regular people who pay mortgages and have children, and that is what I'm truly interested in, is restoring the family unit, bringing integrity into the business and marketplace, and decentralizing the monopolies so that we can really get a grip in the village mindset of restoration of the family unit, health, education, and welfare, and all the good things that our government and our businesses should be involved with but are not. They seem to be involved in control and in power and money. And I just cannot see that as being tenable at this time with the course of events that have happened in the last 20 to 50 years or what is going to happen in the future. We must come into agreement. We must get along, and there has to be this great paradigm shift, which renewable energy represents. The whole entire field is beset with wonderful people who have great ideas and are not holding their cards close to their chest. I give this away to mankind and go for it and enjoy it. I've got a lot of other great ideas, and I want them to share their great ideas with me as well.
Well, that's a great outlook and very conducive to what we like to see as well in open sourcing, so to speak, energy technology. So, Dr. Elijah, I really appreciate you coming on the show, and it's been great talking to you, and we certainly wish you the best in this and the other endeavors you're involved with.
Thank you so much, Sterling.
You take care.
Adios. God bless you.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at pesweeki.com. That's PESWIKI.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.